This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Lynn Mark. And today on The Breakfast Grill, I have with me Jayati Ghosh, Professor of Economics at Jawaharlal Nehru University in India. Thank you very much for joining us this morning, Professor. So one of the things that you've written and spoken extensively about is the economics of care work and the implications when such work, typically undertaken by women, is ignored. So to set the stage, why don't you take us through that? You know, why is it important that we recognize care work as an engine of growth within a country?
Well, you know, care is one of those, I might even call it a guilty secret of every economy. It's actually the underpinnings of all social life, of course, but a lot of economic life. And it is really not recognized as such. Broadly, direct and indirect care. What do we mean by that? We mean, first of all, looking after those who need care, like the young, the old, the unwell, and so on. That is obviously something that is required, but there's also indirect care, which is all of the cooking, the cleaning, the provisioning for the household. All of these things have to be done. But of course, the fact that they are done typically by unpaid labor, and mostly by women doing the unpaid labor within the households, is conveniently forgotten and ignored in all the economic thinking. This has many implications. One is that, in fact, if you didn't have all of this care, obviously none of the other work that people do, which is defined as GDP, could occur. But also that if you didn't do it within the household, you would actually have to farm it out. You'd have to outsource it. You'd have to pay for it. And it turns out that a lot of the increase in services in the developed countries is actually people who are now paying for those things rather than having them delivered for free within households. So it's levels of income that allow you to outsource many of these activities. But the richer you are, the more you can do that. Poorer you are, the more you have to do all of that unpaid. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is, because women do mostly this unpaid work, most of the time society doesn't even recognize that that's work. Endless labor force surveys, when they interview male heads of household and they ask, what does your wife do? They say, oh, she's at home. As if she's basically hanging about painting her nails rather than doing important economic activities. But in fact, there's hardly any woman who doesn't do some work. They contribute, especially in this care work, to her own family and also to the economy and to society in general. But because we don't recognize this, we tend to undervalue both women and what they do. That means that when women go out to work, they don't command as high a wage rate because you can get what she does for free. And then those occupations themselves exact a wage penalty even on the men who work in them. For example, nursing, which is actually quite a skilled occupation, but it doesn't command high wage rates. Domestic workers, the things involved in doing domestic work are not unskilled at all.
So why is it that these skills are undervalued? Is it just the perception or the social values and traditions in societies?
I think it's a larger part of it is that, I mean, I guess in one word, it's patriarchy. But there is a very strong sense in which patriarchy determines what we call the gender construction of society, the broad division of labor, what is seen as women's work and women's responsibility and what is seen for men. It's been found that even with working women, there is what's been called the double burden of paid work and care work. So it's not that the fact that you have some paid job, you still have to come back home and do a lot of domestic work unpaid. And that double burden can also be a huge source of stress and even physical breakdown in many cases.
Professor, you mentioned the word value, and I guess this ties back to the idea of recognition, right? When it comes to the fact that you've said we should recognize these services that women provide in the home as having that value, but how can we actually go about this? You know, it doesn't really make sense, for example, to ask husbands to pay for their wives' work.
Well, that's a really good question. And some people have argued that, look, you should actually start assigning a monetary value to care, even though women don't get paid for it. I don't believe that that is the best way to go. First of all, because I don't think GDP is a good measure of value in the first place. I think the real value of many things is lost when we focus only on GDP, we can have financial bubbles that lead to nothing, which lead to massive increases in GDP. We can have things that are criminal that are generating GDP. And we can have very, very important work done within households or voluntary work in communities. I think instead it's important to recognize, redistribute, reduce, and represent. First of all, we have to recognize that there's all this important care work that is happening. In many societies, it's taken for granted, and the amount of time and effort that it involves is simply not known. So we need to do time use surveys that actually reveal how much people spend on these activities. And of course, that would immediately also bring out the gender imbalances. These are difficult to do, but they're not impossible. And they're expensive, but they're not so expensive that they can't be done. Why is that important? Well, first of all, because it tells you how much actually people are contributing to society, and it enables society to have a better sense of, therefore, the crucial role played by all of those who are doing unpaid labor, especially women. But it also actually helps us to move to the next one, which is that we should reduce as much unpaid labor as we can. So, for example, a lot of the work which people have to do involves drudgery. It's quite arduous, it's repetitive, it's boring. Some of that can be helped through technology or through basic amenities. In India, for example, we know that because of our labor force surveys, we know that about most women in rural areas spend many hours a day just collecting water. Now, that's a huge expenditure of time, and that has actually increased or in recent years. Now, if you actually make available piped water, if that becomes a policy priority, you're doing away with that massive labor time that is being wasted in just collecting water. The third thing you have to do is to actually redistribute this unpaid labor. You reduce as much of it as you can, but of course there will still be a lot of it. But it should be redistributed between paid and unpaid, of course. That is, a lot of it should be transferred to others. And it should be between the market, the government, and households.
When you say redistribute, what exactly is it that you mean, redistributing it between unpaid and paid? Are you advocating, say, for example, adopting more of a share of the global care economy that you've mentioned?
Not really. I'm saying that within a country, a lot of unpaid work done within households can be reduced. And some of that, after it's been reduced, the rest that remains, some of that can actually be shared by other agents. It doesn't all have to be done within the household. Childcare, for example, elderly care, looking after the sick, you know, cooking, cleaning, and so on. So if you have proper, affordable, good quality childcare facilities, for example, nurseries for preschool, which also extend their hours to allow for working parents, both parents to be working, and that they provide good quality, which also, by the way, is hugely employment generating, because these are labor intensive activities, and they can actually employ lots and lots of people. And if you reward those people properly, that actually is a win-win situation for everyone. And moving it out of the household can be shared between the private sector and the government. The other kind of care we ignore, but it's very important, is elderly care. All of us, even in Asia, we are getting older and older, and that people are living longer, and there are longer periods of time when they will require assistance. And we haven't thought about it. We haven't even realized that elderly care is quite a skilled activity. We really need to remember that this is not something you can just dump on whoever happens to be a relative. So redistribution is a very important thing, from the household to the market and government publicly provided care, but also redistribution within the household. Now, that's a tough call. I mean, I think especially those of us who are women know that this is a very complicated negotiation that goes on forever. But it's important, I think, to educate especially the young, especially from school onwards, that it's not just a woman's job. Okay, the fourth R is rewarding. Now, what does that mean? It means that, you know, at this paid and unpaid continuum that I'm talking about, most care work is really not remunerated properly. It's treated as work that anybody can do. Domestic workers are the lowest of the low in most of our societies in terms of occupation. They're treated very badly quite often. They don't have proper working conditions, decent wages. They're not given respect and dignity. We have to actually change that, first of all, by ensuring that the public sector workers who are engaged in these activities are given proper wages, are properly trained, and are given due respect and dignity. So we should be demanding that, first of all, we have many more of them, many, many more care workers, that they are rewarded properly with good wages, with good working conditions, that we insist on them being trained. At the moment, for example, if the idea is that, oh, anybody can be a nursery school teacher, which is wrong. Preschool training, actually, there are all kinds of pedagogic issues. So we are doing ourselves a disservice by saying, oh, anybody can go and be in a kindergarten or anybody can do preschool. Similarly, as I mentioned, with geriatric care, with a whole lot of psychological care and therapy and things like that, we need many, many more care workers, and we need to be paying them properly and giving them good conditions and be cognizant of their need for dignity. Finally, we have to understand what care workers go through, and we can't do that without adequate representation, the fifth R. It's crucial for public employment to take the lead in this, because we know that markets deliver unequal outcomes, that in a lot of these care activities, there are lots of incentives for private sector to deliver poor quality or under-deliver in the interests of higher profit.
And decent protections as well for those employees who do enter into the care sector. I've been speaking with Jayathi Ghosh, Professor of Economics at Jawaharlal Nehru University in India. Stay tuned for more conversations after this on The Breakfast Grill, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to The BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, welcome back to The Breakfast Grill, where I'm speaking with Jayathi Ghosh, Professor of Economics at Jawaharlal Nehru University in India. Now, Professor, you've also written about the increasingly global nature of care work and the fact that particularly when women in particular countries move towards slightly more high income status, they tend to outsource the care work that they do to other oftentimes poorer women. This is very much the case in countries like the Philippines, for example, which exports thousands of domestic workers every single year. And you've written about the fact that this phenomenon can also leave a gap within the source countries. So in these cases, you know, what are the implications of this kind of globalization of care work?
Yes, this is a fascinating thing. One of the interesting features of globalization of the last two or three decades has been the emergence of what I call global value chains in the care economy. Let me give you an example. I have a friend who is a professor in Rome. Because she has a lot of work, she's an economist, she has work with the European Union, she has to travel a lot, she has hired a Filipina woman to come and live with her and take care of her two children. This Filipina woman has come from Metro Manila. She has migrated, so she has moved all the way to deliver these care services. She actually has children of her own. So that's the first phenomenon, which is called displaced motherhood. She's looking after other people's children. But her children back in Metro Manila are able to be looked after by a woman whom she hires. The Filipina woman working in Rome hires somebody back in Metro Manila from her earnings. That woman, in turn, comes from an area in the rural Philippines. And she has farmed out her children to her sister, who is doing this in unpaid capacity, which is actually part of something which is underpinning the entire growth process in Italy and in the European Union. Mm. This globalization of care is very interesting because, of course, it has changed the lives of families all over the world. It's increased incomes at different levels of the value chain, and it has transformed the social relations because, as I said, you have displaced motherhood, you have broken families, not voluntarily broken, but, you know, out of necessity. But it also has macroeconomic implications. And again, this is something that, you know, international policy doesn't seem to recognize. So the countries that dominantly send women out as migrants. The big examples in Asia are the Philippines and Sri Lanka, where women massively outnumber men as migrants. They have very secure remittance inflows. These inflows are largely impervious to business cycles in the host countries. And that's because, you know, even in the middle of a slowdown, you don't immediately get rid of your domestic worker, the care workers that are in there. However, in a slowdown, you do get rid of construction workers and manufacturing workers who are usually male migrants. So the countries that have mostly male migrants in Asia, let's say Pakistan or Bangladesh, they suffer very badly when there is a downswing in the global economy.
So you mentioned a number of things there, Professor. I just want to focus in on your point that this is something that we are seeing happening, particularly in Asia now, because Asia is seeing, in a lot of cases, a growing middle class. Places like Hong Kong have an increasingly high demand for domestic services. But this was not originally an Asian problem, was it? This was something that we used to see, like this kind of devaluing or undervaluing of care work. It's something that used to be seen in Western parts of the world, so Europe as well as America, but now, arguably, it is much less undervalued. Is this something that we could potentially move towards here in Asia, you think?
Oh, absolutely. I think, in fact, some of the Western European countries, not all of them, maybe basically Scandinavia, show us how you can actually have properly rewarded care workers and decent provision of care. So if you look at Sweden, for example, just the number of care workers per population is many, many multiples of what we in Asia provide. One calculation I did was as much as 13 out of every 100. And a large part of these are public sector workers. That's very important because it ensures equitable access, and it also ensures a minimum level of the wages and the working conditions and the social protection. The fact that you have had this higher level of care work and of the reward and remuneration of care work is, I think, a very important direction for us to move in. This is one of those areas which is relatively impervious to technological change. You know how everyone is terrified about the tsunami of the fourth industrial revolution, which is going to come and take away all these jobs? Well, care work is fundamentally relational. So technology can assist you. It can make you do things better. It can reduce some of the drudgery and arduous work, but it can never displace human interaction. Also, it's one of those sectors where, in fact, more workers means better quality, not worse productivity. It's actually better. It's better to have more teachers or a higher teacher to student ratio in schools or in preschools than a lower teacher to student ratio. Mm. The more technology comes to displace the traditional activities, the more we should focus on care and creative industries as the employment of the future.
So in the situation that you described with the Philippines and Sri Lanka, the fact that these cases where remittances from female domestic workers tend to be more resilient over time than male migrant workers, do these remittances that come back into their home countries, does this outweigh whatever losses that the sending country might experience in exporting this labour overseas?
Well, most of our countries, the countries that export all this labour, they are labour surplus countries. So, in fact, they're not really losing out that much. I would say the loss is more at a personal level. It is the loss in terms of, you know, women leaving their homes for extended periods, displaced motherhood, families that feel disoriented and often children growing up not even recognizing their mothers. These are the kinds of losses that sending countries experience. The remittance part is all win-win. It's very good for the sending country. And the great thing about this kind of migration is that women, first of all, they tend to send back a larger share of their income. Secondly, women migrants, their remittances, as I said, are more resilient because their employment and wages are more resilient. And thirdly, in some of these countries, the remittance share is huge as a share of national income. In the Philippines, it's as high as 7% in some years. So imagine what that can do to not just stabilize consumption, but even add to potential investment in that country.
So, Professor, are there quick wins to be made here? Because all of the things that you've described, so the five R's, you know, recognizing the value of unpaid work, reducing, redistributing, rewarding, and adequate representation, all of these to me strike as things that in a lot of Asian countries we would have to work towards in the longer term. So are there measures in the short term that we can take in order to really address this undervaluing of the care economy?
Yes, and the simplest and best and easiest short-term measure, but it will require political will, is massively to expand good quality public employment in the provision of care. Massively increase the number of care workers in looking after small children, in education, in health, in elderly care. You expand this number through government employment, paying them adequately, giving them decent conditions, and ensuring that they're trained. That already will set in motion a bunch of the other things that I have mentioned. It will force people to recognize that this was work that was being done under-recorded and unrecognized. It will force the proper payment of this even by the private sector, and so on and so forth.
So here in Malaysia, in our recent budget 2020, we did see a number of measures introduced, attempt to bring women back into the workforce, including tax incentives for both the female employee as well as the employer. And also we have seen the government take more measures to introduce childcare centres, more childcare centres at places of work, or at least to encourage the setting up of these centres. But in your opinion, are there things that we could be doing better, and are there factors that maybe we aren't taking into account when we try to bridge the gap between women's employment in the unpaid and or the paid sectors?
Well, there are many things. In fact, you know, I mean, yes, increasing the number and so on is nice, but first of all, they have to all be very properly resourced, and you have to have provision for timings that are sensitive to the needs of working mothers. Working parents, should I say, in general. And I think I'm not aware of the conditions in Malaysia fully, but my feeling is that the childcare centres typically open for hours that force some parent to come back early. So you really need to be much more sensitive and flexible to the needs of working parents, including the times taken in commuting, and to have them nearer workplaces, nearer places, nearer the homes, and etc. All of that kind of combination. But that's just one of the many, many things that needs to be done in care. We do inadequately recognize other kinds of care. I mentioned geriatric care. I think that's a big issue, and it's going to become more and more important in the future. But another kind that we leave out completely is psychological care. And the fact that many people with psychological problems go unrecognized and inadequately catered. In most of the developing world, the therapists I know are overworked and under-resourced, and they are simply unable to provide the kind of therapy. So there are many things that could be done, even as small steps, even within a fiscal year, which I think this budget, while these are certainly steps in the right direction, I don't think they go far enough.
Well, thank you very much for speaking to us, Professor. I've been speaking with Jayathi Ghosh, Professor of Economics at Jawaharlal Nehru University in India. I'm Lynn Mark for The Morning Run at BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.